I'm at war. I'm at war with myself. I'm at war with you. I'm at war with everybody. That's why I don't do drugs, because I don't want to be numb. I want to feel the pain. I want the clarity of the challenge. I want to win. I want to kick in the head. I want to tear the throat box out. I want to smash in the lungs. I want to kick in the rib cage. I want to split the spine. And I want to use your phone, make love to your wife, sister, eat your dog, and leave your house with a good cassette.
CITR 101.9 FM, where there's just a little bit of Kim Fowley in each and every one of us.
No, I don't think so.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 5th of December. I'm Ty Grauman.
And I'm Blake Harstad. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:03 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have a report from on the recent Red Earth Creek oil spill on November 27th and the conspicuous lack of information in regards to environmental impacts.
Later in the program, we have an interview with Kirk Christofferson, a PhD student at Sauder, who discusses holiday giving, slacktivism, and who drives charity. We also have Christine Kim in studio to report on recent findings that animals on Canada's endangered species list are continuing to face extinction.
We also have this week's AMS update, as well as special coverage on the Board of Governors meeting. The AMS Council meets every second Wednesday in the sub, and Moira Warburton was there to catch all the action.
And last but not least, an interview with Heather Forbes of First United Church about their storage facility in the downtown east side and how community members can help them secure funding to keep the program running.
But first, some headlines for today. In local news, Petronas delays BC Liquefied Natural Gas Pipeline Project. Malaysian energy giant Petronas has delayed a final investment decision on the proposed plans to export liquefied natural gas from British Columbia. The plan had a pipeline running 900 kilometers from northeastern BC to Leilu Islands, where a new export shipping terminal would ship the gas to West Asian markets. Petronas has cited the new estimations of building costs as the reason for the delay, with the terminal alone budgeted at $11.4 billion, and the project's total at more than $36 billion. Petronas is working with Pacific Northwest LNG, an alliance of Pacific energy exporters, including Petronas, China Petroleum and Chemical Corporation, Indian Oil Corporation Limited, Japan Petroleum Exploration, and Petroleum Brunei, to make the project happen. Pacific Northwest and Petronas had originally set mid-December as a target date for the final investment decision. The move could be an attempt to squeeze prospective suppliers for more funding in order to nudge the project closer to feasibility in the wake of plunging oil prices. President of Pacific Northwest LNG, Michael Culbert, warned in his most recent speech that the window of opportunity for the Leilu Island project is closing. Quote, "We have LNG cargoes that are committed for early 2019, and it is important to keep them on track." With the markets of West Asia eager to purchase cheap North American energy exports, Pacific Northwest LNG is concerned that Canada may miss out on the global race, especially with similar projects looming in the U.S. Mr. Culbert declined to specify a new date, and industry observers expect the decision may be delayed until early spring, though any further delays may put the project at risk of cancellation.
In national news, tomorrow is the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Violence Against Women and marks the 25th anniversary of Montreal's massacre at École Polytechnique in 1989. Across the nation, Canadians will be holding events to remember the victims of this tragedy, as well as all women affected by misogyny. Jessica McCormick, the national chairperson of the Canadian Federation of Students, said that in a statement, quote, "On December 6th, we mark the day that 14 women were murdered on their campus because they were women. A full generation later, gender-based violence and discrimination continues in our communities, including our college and university campuses. Violence against women is most widespread human rights violation worldwide. In Canada, more than 50% of women will experience violence in their lives, most before turning 25. Each year, 1 in 10 Canadian women are abused by their partner, and 25% of women undergraduate students are sexually harassed. In recognition of this, and in memory and solidarity in the struggle against violence against women, Science World, City Hall, and other landmarks in Vancouver will be lit with red lights. Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter is holding an event this Saturday at the Central Branch of the Vancouver Public Library. In media release, Rape Relief stated, quote, "At this all-day event, we will remember the 14 female students that were killed by Lepine, the 12 women who were killed this year in British Columbia by their husbands, and 1,200 missing and murdered Aboriginal women."
In international news, climate scientists warn that 2014 may be the hottest year on record. Rejecting the claim that global climate change had somehow been paused, the UN Weather Agency announced that temperature data from January to October in 2014 is tied with 2010, the hottest year on record. According to the World Meteorological Organization, both periods saw an average increase of 0.57 degrees Celsius over global norms. While certain parts of the world were much cooler than average, including large areas of Canada, the United States, and central Russia, most of the world experienced temperatures above average, with heat waves in South Africa, Australia, and Argentina in January, and much of South America in October. World Meteorological Organization Secretary
Ukraine is ongoing, and we here at News 101 want to bring you an update. Despite a peace deal signed on September 5th, 3 months ago today, fighting between the government and rebel forces has persisted. Thus far, over 500,000 Ukrainians have been displaced within the country's borders, and another 450,000 have fled to Russia during the conflict. Citizens' opinion of the ongoing conflict have been very polarizing. Ukrainians fleeing to Russia claim that they are escaping the rise of the fascist government overrun by nationalists, while pro-Western Ukrainians champion the adoption of the European values and pro-European trade regulations. The many months of fighting have left thousands of the displaced citizens within the Ukraine without sufficient food, shelter, or medical supplies. Tent cities have been erected in Kiev's Independence Square, with other families have been forced to take up shelter within old, disused buildings outside of the capital. On Sunday, Ukrainian officials reported that a large unauthorized convoy of 106 vehicles entered its eastern territory from Russia. Russian officials insist that it is responding to the displacement of Ukrainians within shipment of aid. However, Ukraine claims that Russia is once again interfering with domestic issues. Ukrainian military spokesperson Andrei Lysenko claims that the majority of aid goes towards supplying the rebels with the equipment for combat operations. Human rights activists have said that Russia exaggerates the number of Ukrainian refugees in order to bolster its propaganda war against Kiev. They argue that Russia has also been using the opportunity to fill the economically troubled regions with Russia speakers of the Orthodox faith. Since the armed conflict began earlier this year, over 4,000 Ukrainians have been killed. At this point, both sides have been accused the other of violating the terms of the September 5th truce, and neither side seems willingly to back down. We here at News 101 will continue to hope for a peaceful resolution to the conflict and will report as the situation develops.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
you have an approaching test or exam and need help studying? Well, it's time to prepare yourself. The Study Van, www.studyvan.com, is a 100% free website dedicated to helping you achieve excellence. MCAT, History, Chemistry, French, Math, Biology, the Study Van covers it all. Tools are provided so you can create your own study group and do what you need to do. Ace your exam. The Study Van will help you help yourself. Give it a shot, you have nothing to lose, as once again it is a 100% free studying resource. So remember, when you need to study, go to the Study Van, www.studyvan.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Our lead story, in a continuation from last week's story, two Canadian particle physicists have predicted the existence of two new particles. In 2009, two Canadian particle physicists, Randy Lewis of York University and Richard Wallachin of UBC's Triumph, predicted the existence of two new particles. In the latest experiments at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, Switzerland, the existence of these particles have been confirmed. The particles are very short-lived, lasting 1/1000th of 1/1000000th of a second. The particles have large mass, and this was the key to finding them, because the Large Hadron Collider can produce large amounts of energy. The LHC, or Large Hadron Collider, operates by smashing two protons together at the speed of light, or close to the speed of light, and the resulting collision produced the particles. The particles are made of quarks, and quarks are the fundamental building blocks of matter. For many years, before the 1970s, scientists thought the electron, proton, and neutron were the basic building blocks, but no, it is quarks. In others, UBC News, a scientist invents a new technology for tissue engineering. A UBC student's passion for science, combined with a background in engineering, has drawn interest from Harvard. Hajatollah Reza-Najed, a PhD candidate from UBC's Okanagan campus, has been awarded a $37 prize for an opportunity to test his engineering application at Harvard's prestigious Kadem Hosseini Lab as he completes his PhD in tissue engineering. This forges ties between UBC and Harvard, as Najed will be able to bring the knowledge and expertise he gains back to UBC. Najad's research examines scientific tissue engineering. He developed a method to isolate tiny cells on a microchip by applying electric fields to the microchip. When the electric field is applied, the cells are isolated. Once the cells are isolated, they can be stacked and manipulated in several ways, allowing scientists to engineer new cells. Najad believes tissue engineering can emerge as a significant potential alternative to transplants when there are organ failures. Najad said, and quote, "The ability to isolate micron-sized particles and cells on a microchip will enable researchers to practically redesign how microfluid platforms are used for many bioengineering applications." Najad said, "The Harvard lab is one of the best in the world and leads the way in tissue engineering technology." In other news, in global news, in environmental news, a robot sub has found a surprisingly thick Antarctic sea ice. With the recent news for many decades now about global warmings, people are used to hearing about glaciers melting and sea levels rising. It is therefore surprising to find that the thickness of sea ice in the Antarctic is surprisingly thick. Antarctic's ice paradox has yet another puzzling layer. Not only is the amount of sea ice increasing each year, but an underwater robot shows the ice is also much thicker than previously thought. The discovery adds to the ongoing mystery of Antarctic's expanding sea ice. According to climate models, Antarctic sea ice should be shrinking each year due to global warming. Instead, it is expanding and has set records for the past 3 years. According to Ted Maxim, an oceanographer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts, climate scientists need to know if sea ice expansion includes underwater thickening, because if we don't know how much ice there is, we can't validate the models we use to understand the global climate. Professor Maxim said, in quote, there are significant areas of ice unaccounted for. This is so because of this, an underwater robot, the autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV, is continuing to swim to depths of 100 feet or 30 meters and is looking and drilling in the Antarctic sea ice. The Antarctic sea ice is twice as thick as thought, so scientists may have to revise their climate models. In space news, the Philae lander's final landing spot is unknown. Cameras on the Rosetta spacecraft, which is orbiting Comet 67P, is using its visual searches to home in on Philae lander's final landing site. The cameras are called OSIRIS and NAVCAM, but they have been unable to locate the lander. So now, scientists are using the CONCERT experiment to help locate Philae's final landing spot. CONCERT, C-O-N-S-E-R-T, stands for Comet Nucleus Sounding Experiment by Radio Wave Transmission. In this experiment, radio waves are sent from the Rosetta lander to the comet, and these signals pass through the comet and the nucleus, allowing scientists to analyze the comet's interior. As radio waves pass through different parts of the cometary nucleus, variations in propagation time and amplitude of the radio waves occur, and these can be used to determine properties of the interior of the internal material of the comet. But now scientists are using this to locate where the Philae lander is. This is Marco. You have been listening to the latest science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. Tonight, cloudy with 40% chance of showers, periods of rain beginning near midnight, around 10 to 15 millimeters. Temperature steady near around 5. On Saturday, we're going to be seeing periods of rain ending in the afternoon and then cloudy with 60% chance of showers, around 10 to 15 millimeters. Windy near the water in the morning and high of 8. Saturday night, it's going to be cloudy with a 60% chance of showers with a low of 5. Sunday, it's going to be cloudy with a 40% chance of showers with a high of 10 degrees Celsius. That's this weekend's forecast, brought to you by the Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada. Up next, we have a report prepared by news correspondent Ty Grauman looking at the recent Red Earth Creek oil spill and the lack of information on environmental impacts.
A Canadian natural resources pipeline has leaked 60,000 liters of crude oil in northern Alberta. The spill on November 27th near the small community of Red Earth Creek near Edmonton has not yet been fully investigated, according to the company. The Alberta Energy Regulator has released to the public that it was caused by, quote, mechanical failure, and that it was not from human error. On the regulator's site, they state the spill has released crude oil into muskeg or bogland. However, they also state that tests are still being conducted and that there are no reports to impact on wildlife. As bogland and muskeg are natural habitats for Alberta's wildlife, there appears to be a lack of information. Red Earth, Alberta is an Albertan hamlet rich in wildlife. Many statements have been made that the spill has not affected our wildlife nor the population. In Alberta, another Canadian In April, another Canadian natural resources pipeline leaked near Slave Lake, another small Albertan community. Although 70,000 liters of oil were spilled, the regulators stated that the oil spill was not an emergency and would not have an effect on the environment. However, this spill occurred on a near regularly used farmland. Greenpeace says that the Canadian Natural Resources Pipelines has had twice as many spills as other companies in Alberta. This spill was also credited to mechanical failure. In September, CNRL has had another oil spill in an eastern Alberta community, Primrose. This, too, was not reported to the public as a mechanical failure. The company began working in the area before the spill was cleaned up. CNRL made public statements that the spill had little impact on the environment. A report from Global News was released on December 2nd stating that CNRL had had more oil spills than other oil industries by a wide margin and making themselves the leading company for oil spills by a landslide. So far, CNRL has listed a quarter of their spills as mechanical failures. Environmental groups have begun to advocate that even though CNRL has made claims stating that the majority of their oil spills are due to mechanical failures, there does not seem to be plans in place to prevent those mechanical failures. Additionally, in their public statements, there is often a lack of information about the accidents. After a previous pipeline spill, CNRL released a statement to the public that stated, quote, bitumen emulsion seepage is currently too small to measure. The Pembina Institute, which is an environmental advocacy group, claims that CNRL is, quote, an operator with a below-average safety record. The Pembina Institute is paying close attention to CNRL spills, as well as the risk the company has taken. Canadian Natural Resources is a part of European Union's eco-management and reportedly strive to succeed in protecting the environment, which they are working within. On their website, they have an environmental section which includes that it is, quote, informal information only, that more information can be reached by accepting a legal notice from the company. For more information, you can check out their website at cnrl.com.
Thank you, Ty, for that. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the sound of compost and recyclables going into the garbage. Garbage that ends up in the landfill creating greenhouse gases. This is the sound of a more sustainable campus. You can make a difference when you sort it out. Learn more at sustain.ubc.ca/sortitout.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with Kirk Christofferson, a PhD student at Sauder, who discusses holiday giving, slacktivism, and what drives charity. The vigil for Michael Brown at the Martha Piper Plaza.
I'm Kirk Christofferson. I'm a fifth-year doctoral student at the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia.
And for listeners who maybe aren't up on the current research, can you give us a brief rundown on what you and your colleagues were studying?
Yeah, so I think most of us have been exposed to the many types of what we call token support campaigns that political groups, that nonprofit organizations, and the brands use to engage with consumers and to generate more meaningful support for their organizations. So think of social media campaigns or social media pages, pins, ribbons, petitions, things to that nature. And given how many of them are out there and this huge online presence that all of these organizations are using, we were wondering how effective these campaigns actually are at generating this more meaningful support that they're looking for. So in the case of for-profit organizations, sales, right? In terms of nonprofits, you look for donations or volunteering. Political groups, usually generating votes.
And what did you guys find?
Well, what we found was that there are conditions under which these campaigns can be successful, but there are also conditions under which they're not. And so there's this buzzword that's been kind of traveling around the internet in the last few years called slacktivism, Okay, and so how we define slacktivism is a willingness for consumers to engage in a token or a costless display of support for an organization, but then an accompanying unwillingness to take that next step and provide more meaningful support. So the idea here is that I'm willing to click a button. I'm willing to do something that is very effortless for me to show my support, but then I'm not willing to take that next step and make a donation or to volunteer my time, something that actually incurs a cost to me. Slacktivism does exist, is what we find. And we find that it's most likely to manifest in situations that are observable to other people.
And now, why do people want that observable, like, I'm showing support? What's the phenomenon behind that?
So there are two motivations that are going on here. And I'm trying to try and be careful not to make people look bad, because that's not what's going on here. There is a motivation to support an organization. So we looked at support for organizations that were very positively viewed. Okay, so if you look at the nonprofits that the causes that we studied, ones that are looked favorably upon. Okay, so in some of the lab studies, what we used was ending child poverty or disaster relief, right? So ones that people think, oh, this is a very good cause. Okay, so I do want to support them. So that's one motivation. That's still there. But the other motivation that creeps up when you're in a more observable setting is this motivation to look good, right? This impression management motivation. And what we find is when we give this public token support, it actually satisfies that motivation, right? So if I like a page on Facebook, I know that all of my friends on the newsfeed are going to see that I've liked that page. So I know that I've kind of satisfied that motive that I have. People think that I already support the organization. So this token act satisfies that motive. And as a result of that, it does not make me any more likely to follow through and provide that more meaningful support when I'm asked by that organization.
So in terms of charitable giving, especially during the holiday season, in your opinion, what effect does slacktivism have on people during the holiday season?
Well, the holiday season, and I have to go back and look at the exact percentage, but it accounts for a very, very large percentage, the majority for sure, of donations raised throughout the year for each organization. I mean, obviously it's going to vary a bit. What may happen is when a consumer provides token support, right, so this easy stuff, in a public setting, we find that it does not make us any more likely to follow through and provide this support. So if I'm just receiving a donation request from a nonprofit to donate at the holiday season, a certain percentage will always say yes, right? That's just what we found. We've run control conditions in the lab, and there's a certain percentage that just do it, right? If they lead with a token campaign, however, and I can't speak to what different organizations use at this time of year, then we find that if it's in public, they may not be any more likely to follow through than if the organization just made the phone call. So in effect, what we're showing is that when you give this small support, right, the assumption behind it is that, you know, the classic foot in the door sales tactic, right? I agree to a little thing, I'm much more likely to agree to a larger request. But we find that it's actually no more effective than getting back on the phones and calling.
There's a lot of debate about charitable giving and whether it's a good thing or not. Where do you stand on that?
So may I ask you, what's the debate about? So my initial reaction to your question would be, it's a great thing. If people are willing to make donations and volunteer their time for organizations that they believe in, I think that that's fantastic.
But so I think that a lot of what I've read where it's questioning charitable giving is that it's sort of like, it's like one step up from slacktivism where you give your $2 at Christmas to the Santa paw, and then you don't do anything else during the year.
So you're referring to very minimal effort. So that is slightly different than what we studied. Mm-hmm. I mean, we essentially looked at almost effortless, right? So we didn't look at monetary donations.
Okay, so like that one little step up.
So,
like,
I mean,
do you feel like it would be similar?
Theoretically, it should be similar if people are aware that you've done it. Now, one thing that I can speak to is we found that if you make token support less observable to other people, that actually increases your likelihood to follow through and provide meaningful support. And the reason for that is that you've eliminated this impression management motivation, right? Or if I show my support and no one sees it, well, why did I do that? Well, it must be because I believe in the organization, or I feel that I'm aligned with the organization. And that makes me more likely to support. So if I've maybe given token $2 or $5. Something, again, that I perceive as effortless. Okay, because some people would perceive $5 as effortful. Then if nobody sees me do it, and then I receive a larger request, you know, oh, Kirk, thanks so much for making this small donation. You know, would you be willing to volunteer your time for an hour during, you know, these dates over the holiday season? Well, then I would look back on my previous behavior. Well, yeah, I did support before, so it's going to be, yeah, I mean, I must believe in this organization. So yes, I am more likely to follow. So we found that I mean, that's what our data shows, is that we perceive that we're more aligned with the organization's values.
And it's just in terms of the research, were you working with a specific demographic of people, or was it wide range?
All types. So we ran field studies both on campus here, which encompass everyone from undergraduate, graduate, staff, faculty, you name it. I think it was from, you know, 18 to 65. Okay. We also ran another field study downtown, which crosses all demographics, ages, and genders. In the lab, we ran three studies that are published in the paper, and then two additional ones that were primarily with marketing undergraduates. And again, consistent results across the different populations. So we never noticed any differences, gender, ethnicity, age.
And were you surprised by the results?
On some level. So part of the motivation for the research was, if you go back and look at previous research, there are very competing predictions from established literature streams on why this is happening. So one I mentioned before, the classic foot in the door, I mean, it's almost 50 years old, right? And there's 100 publications on this research. And what that work shows is that after we agree to a small request, we're much more likely to agree to a large request. But on the other hand, there's this huge literature of what's called moral licensing. And what this work shows is that after I do something good, it licenses me, or makes me feel like I've done something, it licenses me to be more selfish. So that would predict that I'm less likely. So here we have pretty competing predictions from very established streams. I mean, how do we reconcile it? What's going on upstairs? And so looking at the impression management literature, looking at what this work called consistency, or I want to behave the same way in multiple settings, literature, we did predict that, well, yeah, once this other additional motive is activated, then it's probably going to be satisfied by this token behavior. So are we surprised, given all of the, you know, kind of banter and discussions about slacktivism? No, I'm not surprised. One of the nice results that came out was that there are a certain subset of people that do respond positively to this public token support. And these are people that are already very emotionally connected to an organization. Okay, so for people essentially that have shown support before, or let's say you're looking at somebody who's experienced or had a family member have a specific disease, okay, so a specific type of cancer, for example, they're obviously very emotionally connected to that cause. And so once they give their public token support, they're actually more likely to follow through and support. And the other thing I guess I would say is that it's not that token support makes me less likely. So consistently throughout the lab studies and the field studies, we ran what's called a control condition. So we ran a condition under which we just asked people to support, okay? No token behavior. And what we found was, in the public setting, it's no different than the control, right? So there's a certain subset that are going to say yes, and this public doesn't differ from that. So unfortunately, we don't get an increase, which, when you're a nonprofit organization, you're dedicating significant time and money into these campaigns, you want results. We're not showing that they have any positive effect, but we're also not showing that it's, you're less likely. You're just not any more likely.
And I guess my last question for you, from the research that you've done, what makes an effective and sustainable campaign?
Well, there are two things that we studied that can actually be put into play by organizations. The first would be to make your token campaign, if you're going to run one, less observable to other people. A public pin or ribbon campaign, that's a little bit more challenging. You could present people, you know, a pin in a little case to take with them. One of the manipulations that we used was we offered people a pin or a fridge magnet. Right? The argument there is that the fridge magnet, yes, it'll still be seen by your family, but it's in a less observable setting to other people. So there are ways that you could make it less observable to other people. If you're looking at online, you know, many organizations have Facebook groups. Make it a private group. Right? So there are ways that can increase the more meaningful support. And the other one that we found that you could do is you could actually draw attention to the alignment of values between the organization and the support in public. So we found this mitigated slacktivism. So let's say if you're running a social media campaign, let's just use a Facebook page because it's an easy example. you can say on the page, change the content. Say, you know, this is what our organization stands for. Your support shows that you stand for it as well. So by drawing attention to the alignment of values, we found that even in public, that would mitigate the slacktivism as well.
Thank you, Morgan. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite. Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Blake Harstead.
And I'm Ty Grauman. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have Christine Kim in studio to report on recent findings that animals on Canada's endangered species list are continuing to face extinction.
Hi. So the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, also known as COSWIC, recently had a meeting with the Minister of the Environment, Leona Aglukic, to discuss their findings regarding species at risk within Canada. Their reports reflected a growing list of Canadian wildlife at risk of extinction. More specifically, COSWIC assessed 35 wildlife species in varying degrees of danger. The degree ranges from extinct, which is a wildlife species that no longer exists, to special concern, which is for wildlife species that may become threatened or endangered because of a combination of biological characteristics and identified threats. From this past meeting, COSWIC identified one extirpated species, which is a species that no longer exists in the wild in Canada, but exists elsewhere in the world, 14 endangered species, which means these species face imminent extirpation or complete extinction, 6 threatened species, and 14 special concern species. To name a few specific species from COSWIC's report, we have the southern beluga that has been identified as an endangered species. The southern beluga is known to live in one of the busiest and most heavily industrialized waterways in Canada, the St. Lawrence Estuary. While these belugas were once numbered as high as 10,000, today their population is fewer than 1,000. The Sable Island sweet bee is found only on Sable Island, which is located 150 kilometers off the coast of Nova Scotia. This species has been assessed as threatened, as climate change has threatened to break their fragile habitat on the island through rising sea levels and an increase in the frequency and intensity of storms. The Newfoundland caribou population has declined 68% since the last COSWIC assessment in 2002, but the reduced hunting rates have recently shown improvements to calf survival rate and thus suggests that the population of Newfoundland caribou is recovering. This species was assessed under the category of special concern. Brett Favero, a research scientist at Memorial University, told CBC, "What's at risk is biodiversity in Canada. Extinction is forever. If something goes extinct, this is millions of years of evolution that we're losing." Interestingly enough, the process of animals being labeled officially as at risk occurs in two steps. First is through the recommendation of COSWIC. COSWIC gathers information from Aboriginal communities, governments, academia, and other organizations to accurately assess the status of wild species considered to be at risk within Canada. Summaries of their assessment can be viewed publicly on their website, www.coswic.gc.ca. The second step in the process of animals being labeled officially as at risk is through the golden stamp by the Minister of Environment. Favero explains his concern with the second step in the following quote. "The government can choose not to list the species even if it needs listing. That decision takes into account how expensive it would be to protect them." However, further research on the creation of COSWIC reflects a government-level concern for the issue of at-risk species within Canada and the large expenditure by the government to match. COSWIC was created under the Federal Species At-Risk Act, also known as SARA, in 2002. The purposes of the Species At-Risk Act are to prevent wildlife species in Canada from disappearing and to provide for the recovery of wildlife species that are extinct, endangered, or threatened. This initiative also established the Habitat Stewardship Program, HSP, which allocates $9 to $13 million a year to projects that conserve and protect species at risk and their habitats. Unfortunately, due to Leona Aglukec's recent minor scandal regarding her reading the newspaper during a question and answer period, which understandably appeared insensitive to her constituents, Aglukec has yet to respond to this issue of the rising at-risk species within Canada. However, COSWIC does have another scheduled meeting in Ottawa, April of next year. On this topic of at-risk species, it is important to note the growing global trend in which endangered animals are still being hunted and sold on the black market. The Independent featured a recent article by Lizzie Diarden revealing a report showing more than 33,000 animals or their parts up for sale on the illegal online trade market over the course of 6 weeks. In the UK alone, 1,087 items were found on sale and in total valued at more than £300,000. The majority of sales were of ivory, and Tanya McCrae Steele, who is the campaigns and enforcement manager for the International Fund for Animal Welfare, said, quote, like it or not, much of the online and offline trade in wildlife and their parts is completely legal. But our investigators had grave concerns that a significant number of ads had been placed by wildlife cyber criminals, end quote. The nonprofit organization that is the International Fund for Animal Welfare is currently focusing on urging government and law enforcement agencies to tackle wildlife cybercrime with stricter laws. This organization is also protesting against the Canadian government for allowing whale meat shipments to travel through the country from Iceland to Japan. While this meat is prohibited under Canadian law due to the endangered status of whales on Earth, the shipments are not restricted as their final destination is outside Canada. Iceland, which is one of the only countries that still allows commercial whaling, has been under pressure to change over the past decade. But over the course of a few months in Canada, a petition calling on all whale shipments to halt has already gained over 60,000 signatures. Thus, while the increasing number of at-risk species in Canada is alarming to some extent, the flurry of outrage it has sparked within Canadians and the number of related issues this recent update by COSWIC has highlighted is perhaps even a more cause for concern. I'm Christine Kim. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Christine. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
A large man wearing green pants grabbed a woman by the hair and slammed her face into the glass window of a fire extinguisher case. He pulled her head back and hit her again, continuing to do so until the glass broke. The woman sustained deep cuts all over her face and eventually became unresponsive. The man then released his grip and she fell to the floor. This is a scene from an Emmy Award-winning cartoon. If we want violence against women to stop, shouldn't we stop treating it like a joke? Join the conversation at #NotOkay.
You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have an interview with Heather Forbes of the First United Church about their storage facility in the downtown East Side and how community members can help them secure funding to keep the program running. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke to Heather earlier this afternoon.
Heather, thanks for being with us here today on News 101.
It's lovely to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit what you do with First United Church?
So First United Church is a service agency in the downtown East Side. We've been here over 125 years, and what we do is we provide daytime services and shelter for people experiencing homelessness in the downtown East Side. And so our programs include everything from shelter to meal programs to legal advocacy to daytime drop-in programs like a seniors program and a women's program. And one of our coolest programs is our storage facility.
And so it's my understanding that that first opened in 2009?
Yes, the storage facility opened in 2009. The initial grant money came from the City of Vancouver through a one-time-only funding related to the Olympics. And what it did on our building, which is at Hastings and Gore, we have a underground parking facility. And we converted part of that facility to storage for people experiencing homelessness or insecure housing. So what we have is space that you can... If you're accessing the storage facility, you come up and someone meets you at the service counter. And you tell them your name and BIN number, and then you're able to access your storage unit. So we have capacity for 200 people, and a large chunk of that is in storage bins. So it's up to 50 pounds of storage.
Okay.
Or there's space for carts, or there's space for luggage. So depending on what your needs are.
So now 200 units sounds like a lot, mm-hmm. but how much need are you guys seeing for the storage space?
We are really universally full. Pretty much every night since we opened, it's been in use. And right now, every day we very regularly have turnaways.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're seeing is we've got people that will come first thing in the morning trying to see if there's any opening, and then they'll come again later in the day to see if someone's given up their spot that day. So we're definitely running at capacity. We're the only storage facility of this kind in the Lower Mainland, okay. as far as we know, and certainly the only one of its kind in the Downtown East Side.
And what's the benefit of people being able to store their belongings during the day?
For people, either you're street entrenched or you're living in a shelter or your housing is really precarious, you need a place to keep your belongings and to know that they're safe and secure. So maybe you are sleeping on the street or you're sleeping in a place where your stuff isn't secure. And so it's really important to know that your core belongings are safe. It's also really important just for your mobility. If you're someone that has all of your belongings with you, you can't access services. You can't go to a regular grocery store. You can't go to an appointment. You can't go to the doctor's office, because if all of your belongings are with you in a shopping cart, you can't even physically get in the door, let alone overcome the social stigma that comes with carrying all of your belongings with you.
Right.
So people come and keep their core stuff with us, and then they're able to go apply for housing, go apply for a job, go to work, which is a really amazing example of resilience is that the people leave their things with us, go off to work, come back, get their things, and go off to wherever they sleep that night. An amazing mm-hmm. feat that people do that every day.
Now, and is this storage? Is it just daytime storage?
No, it's overnight storage as well. So we've
okay.
got people that use it. People experiencing homelessness. There's a lot of people that experience it for a short time. So they need the storage facility for less than a month while they're in crisis, and they need a safe place for their belongings while mm-hmm. they deal with it with an emergency. And then we have people that have a seasonal need, and then we have people that have been using it for years, and they've maintained the same bin for years. And that's because some people, for a lot of different reasons, are and will remain street entrenched. And for other people, they just know that their housing is insecure, so they're going to be in and out of housing. But they know that they need to keep their stuff safe, and so they maintain a bin with us or other form of storage, and they check in with us every day because they know that having that piece of security, that having your core belongings safe, is just integral to being able to have a life where you can move freely.
Thank you very much for your time, Heather.
Great.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. Heather, thanks for being with us here today on News 101.
It's lovely to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit what you do with First United?
First United Church's storage for the homeless is currently in the running for Aviva's Community Fund. You can help them secure funding for the continuation of this program by voting for them online at www.avivacommunityfund.org and searching First United Church.
For our final segment, we have this week's AMS update, as well as special coverage of the Board of Governors meeting. The AMS Council meets every second Wednesday in sub, and Moira Warburton was there to catch all the action.
I'm here with AMS correspondent Moira Warburton. How are you?
I'm good, Costa. How are you?
Not too bad. The UBC Board of Governors met earlier this week, correct?
Yes, they did.
Can you give me a little rundown of what happened?
Yeah, they met earlier this week to talk about several things, the most interesting of which was the current international student tuition fee raises that are being discussed. The AMS was there. They were on there on behalf of the students, as was I Am a Student, the protest group that's been formed since these tuition raises were introduced. They both gave presentations. The board asked that just the AMS represent students, but I Am a Student was there too. Yeah, so the AMS was just basically the nub and gist of their presentation was that tuition raises on their own, if they're justified, are understandable, but the AMS, on behalf of the students, doesn't feel that the university has justified these tuition raises adequately.
Right. I also hear there was a problem with where they were criticized for the lack of consultation.
Yeah, that was the other thing the AMS had to say, was there has been very little consultation, or there's been consultation, but it's been pretty perfunctory from the university's end. There's been basically what the Chris Roach, Board of Governors representative for the students, said was that
for the Graduate Student Society.
Yes, for the Graduate Student Society. He said that there really needs to be a lot more communication and open, meaningful consultation between the university and the students, because right now there's a big disconnect between UBC and UBC students, and that disconnect really shouldn't be happening. Like, we're a post-secondary education institution. We're all going towards the same goal of, you know, bettering our world through education. There shouldn't be this disconnect between the institution and the students. It should be the same thing.
What was the reaction like from the Board of Governors to the fact that there were student protesters there?
Not super positive. As I said, they didn't want the I Am a Student group to speak at all, but the I Am a Student group insisted. They weren't very open to the whole process at all. Actually, they basically said that we'll try consultations, but it's a big budget, it's a big amount of money that will be increasing. There isn't that much consultation we can have just because there is so much flow of cash that's going to be happening. It's a little difficult for us to be precisely consulting on every dollar that's spent. I mean, Gupta basically brushed it off. He said it's my job to run this university, that's what I'm going to do.
The new international student increases go into effect at the end of this year.
Yes.
Thank you, Moira, for being here.
Bye.
That's our program for today, December 5th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email at news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Ty Grauman.
And I'm Blake Harstead. Today's broadcast was produced by Morgan Yee. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.